620 WGN. Hi there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I hope you are outside enjoying this very beautiful weather. As we like to say, our February selves will thank us for soaking in this beautiful weather now. So, indeed, thank you for being with us today, and I always appreciate you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. We've got lots to do on the program today. We're going to be talking a little bit later about Nike and how they're switching to a little more online-based sales model and how that's affecting their bottom line. And we're going to be taking a look on the other side of news at Medicaid in Illinois and the first cell phone we all had. It was a Nokia, wasn't it? I know, mine was too. We're going to be talking about that and what that company is up to now. But right now, we have a very special guest in studio. Alep Shah, who is co-founder of So Me Connect, is here. Thanks for being with us today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. Well, so So Me Connect is a really interesting company because a lot of times, particularly in the digital realm, it's much after the fact. It's way, way after the fact. Then you can look at numbers and then decide what you should have done at that time. But you're in a much more hands-on place, being involved kind of from the jump.
Absolutely. And I think as you talk about numbers, I'm an accountant by trade. So I studied accounting at DePaul.
So numbers are your thing.
Numbers are my thing. And I think that's what makes SoMe a little bit more unique and a differentiator. You know, we have a great creative mind that creates awesome social content. Like, think about those animated GIFs you see with those fuzzy cats and video clips, you know, messaging, posts, copy, and really engaging and creating community. And that's what I think we do best.
Yeah. And, you know, I think what's tricky with a lot of times when we're talking about digital media agencies, I think sometimes things get sort of lost in buzzwords. And it's like, oh, another agency doing a thing, saying around, like throwing around the word strategic integration and, you know, words like that. But it really seems, looking around the So Me Connect website, which you should all visit, SoMeConnect.com, and you can look at the about page there. It really just seems a lot more straightforward with what you're doing. It's like the no nonsense. Here's what we're doing and here's how to get there.
Absolutely. I think about this because I used to be in retail. It's all about location, 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 right? So if I have like a social content library, so meaning like some videos, some photos, how do I get that in the right place at the right time to the right audience? And really, it does come about locations. I think about the world in these three platforms. It's actually pretty straightforward. There's Facebook, there's Google, and there's Amazon. You know, touching on that Nike segment that's coming up, it's such an interesting story about how a brand like that is now coming onto Amazon. And how, you know, it takes advantage of the Amazon Prime world and all of us that use it constantly and almost automatically with one click.
You know, I'm glad to hear you say it, because I think a lot of times what we see is this is the way we do it and this is the way we're going to keep doing it until you're forced to change. And so what I really like about what you're saying right now, it seems to be a sense of knowing where your customers are and really adapting. And because to me, with anything digital, the only constant is that it's going to change in a very relatively short period of time. And evolving with that customer behavior is really key. And I think I see so many brands just, nope, this is the way we do it. This is the way we're going to keep doing it. And I think it seems that a lot of what you're doing is helping brands to be that flexible.
Absolutely. I think it's key, right? When we started our agency, Pinterest launched within 2 or 3 weeks. So when you talk about change, it happens constantly. And Amazon is one of those things that we think about is rapidly changing our world. And when you think about those brands that are kind of saying, hey, here's how we've always done things, and we need to be on the shelf, and we need to be at, you know,
have a store
mm-hmm. and have, you know, it's now more about experiences. It's about paying to be in your newsfeed, which you walk around with 24/7. You log into Facebook, Instagram. And how do I get to Amy? How do I get to Alep? And how do I get them with a message that they're going to remember, but then also come back to them 3 days later with that same message?
And how are you solving for that? That seems like a thing that's much easier said than done.
It is. Totally. It's a great challenge to think about. And the way our industry works is changing a little bit. It's no longer about doing this grand 2-3 day shoot and then producing one great commercial. There's still a time and place for that. But now it's working within that 2 or 3 day shoot to create 180 pieces of disposable content. This is stuff that you see that pops into your newsfeed that you can just kind of flick through mm-hmm. And then consume, share, or save for later. And that's what we really think about now.
And that to me, that's a very, that's an important step that keeps coming up on the show as I've been talking to more and more small businesses, not just in the marketing realm, but in a lot of areas, that it's less about this, you know, hiring models for this big sexy shoot and this big campaign. And it's much less about that and far more about digestible. I think someone said they called it snacks versus the main, you know, the main meal, right?
Well, it's hard to read on that phone. That's what I think about all the time. It's like, can a sentence or can a picture do the job? And I really want to like engage with you, the customer, and hear your story. Cater and create content that actually speaks to you, that you're interested in. And it might be a very micro segment, but I'm going to pay to get to you. And I might have a slightly different message for a different audience. That could be by age. It could be by interest. It could be, hey, they live in the city or in the suburbs. We all respond to different things. And I think the secret ingredient really is letting the data lead the creative and not the other way around. You can spend a lot of time just looking at numbers. You know, I know that because I'm
you
from that world.
You should know, right.
But I got into the business because what I love is I can see what's going to affect the top line. And that's the story that we want to think about.
Definitely. And so in addition to a couple of things that we've touched on, what are some of the things that you just, it just makes you want to just, you know, hit your head on your desk because it's like the thing that gets overlooked again and again, or that's so commonly misunderstood, especially with small businesses. Where are they kind of stepping in it over and over again?
Really, I think it's in two areas. One is the emphasis on creating organic content. That's kind of the content that you post on your Facebook page day in and day out. Maybe it's a retail shelf display, or maybe it's an event that you're running, and not thinking about the distribution piece of it. Today, in this world, 99.9% of brands have to pay to get into our newsfeed. There's no other way that anyone's going to see it. So we really advocate less is more. Do 8 or 9 posts and put some money behind it and make them quality. I think the other area that people get hung up on is really being too many places all at once. So, hey, you don't need to be as a small business or any business for that matter. There's no need to be on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Google, all this stuff. Pick one or two channels and excel at it.
And do it really well. A lot of times see brands that don't necessarily have a visual component just beating a dead horse on Pinterest. Mm-hmm. In particular, I see authors sometimes just pinning their book cover over and over. And I'm like, that's not what you need to do. Don't do that. Yep. Just focus on, you know, why did you write that book? What's your story? What's the story in the book? What's the book about? You know, do that kind of stuff. And it goes so much better.
Absolutely. And here's a really interesting thing that I find too working with businesses is that they forget they Google stuff themselves. And so a lot of businesses come to us to talk about social media when it's really, I just need to get them in that first 2 or 3 spots in that map in Google so someone can find their business. Because a lot of us still like to go out there on the streets and shop. And let's make it easy for them to mm-hmm. do it.
Indeed. And then I think a lot of, you know, right now we're having a lot of conversations with small businesses about net neutrality, as that's kind of on everyone's mind mm-hmm. too right now, which is a whole other topic. We need a whole other show for that, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I think it's a rich topic. And from a SEO perspective, someone that works in search engine optimization, that's a scary topic too.
Yeah.
To think about.
Yeah, it really is. I think it'll be very interesting. We'll certainly be following it and talking about it a lot here on this program. So where can people go to find out more about SoMe Connect and connect with SoMe Connect?
Absolutely. Find us at SoMeConnect.com and or on LinkedIn. Type in Alip Shah and I'd love to talk.
Great. Sounds good. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
All right. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to be talking about Nike and how their sales are shifting to a much more online model. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today and sharing part of your very beautiful Saturday with me. Always grateful to you for that. Still lots to do on the program. A little bit later on the other side of news, we're going to be talking with Crane's healthcare reporter about Medicaid in Illinois and how it's shifting a bit. We're going to be talking about that. And we're going to be talking about Nokia. I know it was my first phone, probably yours too. A lot of people had that first phone made by Nokia, what they're doing now and how they've evolved over time. So we're going to be taking a look at that. But right now we're joined by Sarah Germano, who is a reporter at Wall Street Journal, to talk with us about Nike's increasingly internet sales-based model, because they've, you know, always done things a certain way, but now they're shifting and showing up in different places. Sarah, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Thanks. So tell us about how Nike is shifting, because we're starting to see them on places we have not seen them in ever, like Amazon, which is very interesting and kind of a bit of a shift for them for sure, but also kind of a tell of the times, because we're seeing more and more brands showing up on places like Amazon these days.
Oh, totally. Nike's decision to sell on Amazon is sort of a long time coming, and it's this like fascinating study between sort of the old world of retail being Nike and like this new era that we're in where shopping is increasingly done online, and there's no better example of that than Amazon. Nike is traditional, as I say, because they sort of perfected the wholesale business. They have some of their own retail stores, but they mostly sell to like Foot Locker and Dick's Sporting Goods and your mom and pop sneaker shops. And that was the foundation of their business for decades. Now that customers are shopping more and more online, and Amazon, as we all know, has sort of grown into this behemoth, they think of themselves as the everything store. And they were pretty much everything except for Nike. Nike was probably one of the biggest holdout brands. They didn't want to sell there. Nike likes having control over how its products are arranged in stores and the branding around them. They really couldn't come to terms. But this spring, the two companies have been talking for close to a decade about whether or not Nike would come aboard. But they finally reached an agreement this spring. And it really is, like you said, just sort of a indication of the fact that retail is changing and Nike has to adapt.
Indeed. And a lot of times we see that a brand won't shift or change until they have to, usually in the form of some kind of financial loss. Was that the case with Nike, or were they preempting any sort of loss with this move?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of the latter, I would say. I mean, Nike is the largest sportswear brand in the world. They did $34 billion in sales last year. They're not in any sort of dire straits. That said, they've taken notice of the shift that consumers aren't going to malls in droves anymore. I think most of us have probably been to some shopping center that wasn't quite the, shining behemoth that it used to be. And things are more convenient and sold online. So Nike's calculation was, they're trying to sell a lot of their shirts and shoes on Nike.com and through their own sales app. But because Amazon has become this destination where people can buy toilet paper and tweezers and lamps and everything you could want, they realize they need to have their products available there too, so that they can kind of adapt towards this this new era of retail.
Right. Is there any sense that you got in working on this story that there's fear from Nike about perhaps shifting a little bit of its, maybe damaging its brand or shifting its perception with consumers by this move and making it so much easier to get?
Yes, there's definitely, I mean, Nike, like I said, is a $34 billion brand. They're running a huge, huge ship. And any sort of pivot you make, even if it's gradual, but like we said, for this, it's just such a huge shift for them in terms of the way they organize their business. There's definitely some minute effects so far as to how their brand is perceived. If you take a look at sort of sneakerhead culture, a lot of that is totally grassroots organic, built up through local mom-and-pop sneaker shops who say that they've had a tougher time getting, top desirable product from Nike, because Nike now has to allocate to so many different places, not only Foot Locker, not only the mom and pop shops, but now also to Amazon. To Nike's credit, they do a pretty good job of giving each tier of retailer something different. So like the product you would get at a Foot Locker isn't quite the same as what you would get at Kohl's. But that is something that I think people in the retail industry are definitely worried about, as to how if you can get Nike kind of everywhere, will that dilute demand for the brand in some of its more revered traditional mom and pop stores?
Right. And I wonder, too, Nike has done some pretty high profile collaborations with celebrities here and there. And I think, you know, they did one with Drake at one point. I think it'll be interesting to see if that shifts any, too. Maybe less collaboration or more to try to kind of keep that cool factor going.
Yes. And the other piece about this that we haven't discussed yet is that their rivals have become, you know, bigger and bigger and gaining more influence in culture. The most famous of which being Adidas's partnership with Kanye. His Yeezy shoes are, you know, have been the coolest thing around for the last 2 years, I want to say. Under Armour has Steph Curry. You know, his shoes, none of those products are quite at the established sales behemoth that the Jordan brand is for Nike. But they're aware of the fact that it's not just their game anymore. They have to find newer, up-and-coming, younger artists and athletes to partner with to still sort of drive the culture. You mentioned Drake. They work with Drake and Jordan Brand. They have A$AP Bari as part of the A$AP Mob in this hip-hop collective. They've also done partnerships with chefs now. They released a shoe last month with David Chang at a Momofuku brand, a restaurant, I should say. So they're definitely trying to figure out, okay, where is the next generation of culture coming from and how do we partner with them?
Yeah, it is interesting to watch brands kind of get their sea legs when they make a pivot. Sometimes really, really cool things happen. Sometimes they kind of flail around for a minute, sometimes a little bit of both. So it'll be interesting to see how things shake out for Nike. But thank you so much for being with us today, Sarah Germano, reporter at Wall Street Journal. WGN. Hi there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. I hope you're able to get outside and enjoy some of this very beautiful summer weather at some point today. So, lots to do here on the second half of the show. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about Nokia. Remember them? It was my first cell phone. I bet yours too. A lot of people had that brand. Anyway, we're going to be talking about them and how they've been shifting and how they're about to shift again. But right now, we are joined by Kristen Shore. She is the healthcare reporter at Crain's Chicago. She wrote about how as Medicaid in Illinois becomes more privatized, it's harder for health plans to find enrollees. Kristen, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us and taking part of your Saturday to be with us and break all this down, because there's so much to it as we have been sorting this and following this story and all the moves made by Rauner and Co. It does get a little bit confusing to follow and to keep it all straight. And it seems like new details keep emerging that shift the narrative a little bit. So what is the latest as we're following this story about Medicaid?
Well, in terms of what Governor Rauner would like to do with the Medicaid Managed Care Program, so essentially in the state of Illinois, you know, Medicaid is the government health insurance program for the poor and disabled. About two-thirds of those enrollees right now are actually being overseen by private insurers. So the state has created this managed care program with the idea of focusing on prevention. So, say, Blue Cross, Aetna, they are overseeing a portion of Medicaid enrollees, and they are paid by the state to really focus on prevention, get people to the doctor with the overall goal of making them healthier, and then saving money for the Medicaid program in the long run, which, you know, these days is even more important than ever, because we not only had a state budget crisis, but we also have some upheaval in D.C. with a lot of federal lawmakers really wanting to squeeze out savings and cut money from the Medicaid budget overall. That means that Illinois and every other state in this country could be receiving even less money for Medicaid. So, you know, we really need to focus on trying to, focus on prevention and save the state money. That's at least Governor Rauner's goal.
Yeah. There's a couple of interesting and very unique issues and kind of pain points that you surface in the piece that you wrote. Everybody head to chicagobusiness.com and look for this story, because it is really interesting and breaks it all down really wonderfully. And we're going to talk about some of those numbers here in just a little bit. But one of them is really about kind of the not great job that the insurers are doing it, tracking down and working with Medicaid recipients. And then the other major issue that you surface here is how the state isn't really realizing the savings or efficiencies as a result of kind of outsourcing this, as it were.
Right. So, I mean, it's like you mentioned before when you were just initially introducing this, I mean, healthcare is very complex. It's very confusing. And so, and then if you consider the Medicaid population, so in terms of for the insurers, trying to find their enrollees, you know, they're working with people who might not be used to going to the doctor, might not have a steady address, just might be concerned more with finding their next meal, finding their next place to stay. At the same time, the insurers were saying that they're getting important information from the state. Every month they get a batch of new names of people to go and track down and try and engage with them to get them to a doctor. And they say right off the bat, those addresses and phone numbers are wrong. But at the same time, the state is paying these insurance companies to do exactly this, to administer these benefits, to get people involved and focused on prevention. So we took a deep dive and we were focusing to see how well these health insurers were actually finding their members, which is, you know, one of the most basic things of managed care is if you're going to be seeing if people need extra medical care, you've got to find them first. And so we found a wide range of this. We've got some of these insurance companies steadily performing in the single digits, meaning Aetna, for example, is one of the largest insurers in the country, consistently found just 4 to 12% of their enrollees each month over the past 2 years. On the higher end, County Care, which is a health insurance program run by the Cook County Health System, and Blue Cross, which is the largest insurer in the state, consistently perform the best, finding more than half their members. You know, also a caveat in this, making this even more complex, is that we essentially made Medicaid managed care law as of 2015. We wanted half of the Medicaid enrollees in state to be in a managed care program. So these insurers were hit with a deluge of new members really quickly. Enrollment, for example, in managed care in 2014 was only about 10% of all the state's Medicaid recipients. Today, it's about 65%. So it was a huge aggressive push by the state to do this. There's a lot of complex things about this program. And so the state is and the insurance companies are trying to work to make this better. And that's why Governor Rauner also is overhauling the program, because he thinks that the insurance companies can do a better job and actually save more money.
Right. As I said, it's a complex story. As you start peeling layers, it doesn't get necessarily simpler. There's just more considerations to make. And the numbers here are interesting, particularly the numbers around Aetna that you mentioned. I mean, only finding 4 to 12% of enrollees each month, that's very significant. So we have a wide swath of people that are not receiving care they ostensibly need. So where is the balance to be struck here, and how can this be fixed?
Well, I think that's a good question. I mean, I talked to a lot of people for this story, a lot of experts around the country, and pretty much all of them told me when I asked them, how many people do insurers really need to find and engage to make sure people don't fall through the cracks? And they mainly said, think of it as commercial insurance. Think of it as insurance you get through your job. You know, you don't have a doctor or your health insurance company calling you every day to see if you need to go to the doctor. And so they say that not everybody needs to be found. But the thing is, in managed care, I mean, it is a government program. The state is paying these insurance companies to focus on prevention, to save money overall. And so, I mean, if you can't find the people in the first place and get them to answer basic questions about their health to see what they do need, I mean, then, right. I mean, how are you overall going to start to save money for the state and make all these people healthy? One of the things that the governor is encouraging is health plans to do more, and also the health plans, some of them are already doing this, is to partner with organizations that know this population really well. So AIDS Foundation of Chicago, Thresholds, Heartland Health Outreach, these are nonprofits that already treat the homeless, people who have chronic conditions, people who have mental illness. So they're out canvassing neighborhoods, working with this population every day. And so they already have contracts to go out and help these insurance companies find their enrollees, or they're hoping to get more of them. as these health insurance companies wait to see if they're going to get their contracts renewed, which should happen in the next few weeks or so.
Super interesting stuff. And so are there other major metro areas or other states that have struggled and come through this that we could look to perhaps for how another area has worked all this out?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question. So in the U.S., 1 in 5 people are in Medicaid. And of that, almost 75% of people are in managed care. So this country is moving quickly to managed care because, you know, most states see it as a way to predict costs, because in managed care, the idea is that you pay insurance companies a fixed amount of money each month for their enrollees. So you know what you're paying them essentially each year. Some of these states have done, you know, a good job, have been successful at managed care. New York, you know, obviously a, you know, huge state, pointed out to me that they have actually saved, since requiring managed care for the bulk of their Medicaid population, they have saved about 12% of costs over the last few years. But then again, Connecticut, I talked to them, and they're one of the few states that actually cut ties with their insurance companies that were in managed care back in 2012, because they were seeing that it was just being too expensive. And so Connecticut brought managed care back in-house. So while most states are headed this way, you do have a few outliers like Connecticut that are saying, you know what, we think we can still do a better job at managing the health of our Medicaid enrollees. But most people I talk to think that managed care will increase in this country, especially as states need to start watching their Medicaid budgets more closely if we do have a lot of changes at the federal level, because the federal government typically, you know, matches state funds. They essentially split the bills for Medicaid. So if you have fewer federal dollars coming in, then how are you going to balance those costs?
Right. That was exactly what I was going to ask you about next, changes at the federal level. Indeed. Well, so much to consider, so many pieces of this, but we appreciate you joining us and helping us break this down today. Kristen Schorsch, healthcare reporter at Cranes Chicago. We will keep turning to you for the latest on all this to help us keep making sense of all of this stuff. Thanks for being with us today.
Sure. Thanks. Have a great day.
You too. All right. We're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are talking about that cell phone that we all had first. You know the one, that big old brick of a thing. Yeah, we're talking about that. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. In 20 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Lots of people walking by, smiling and waving on Michigan Avenue. Everybody's out enjoying the sunshine. Our February selves will thank us for doing that, as I like to say. Well, still plenty to do here on the show before we turn things over to the Startup Showcase coming up here after the 1 o'clock news break. We are joined now by Drake Bennett, a staff writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, who wrote about Nokia, how and why they missed the smartphone revolution. Because if you will recall, I bet they made your first phone. I know they made mine, and it was a big old brick of a thing. Way, way big old brick, blue plastic thing, way pre-iPhone. Somewhere in the 90s, that's when I had that. Anyway, we're going to be talking about that and what they're doing now, since they really didn't get in on that, you know, the big Samsung and iPhone and all that hustle. They kind of did their own thing. So let's see where they are now. Drake, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. So talk to us a little bit about this company, because as I said, this was a phone that a lot of people had when cell phones first were kind of a thing, shortly after they were kind of tethered to cars and they were after the big, big blocks of things. But it was kind of the first cool phone that a lot of people had anyway, right? And then they got very quiet. We didn't hear from them for a very long time. And there's been shifts all along, but there seems to be another shift happening with them. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Nokia was a bit of an unlikely company to kind of rocket to prominence and become the global leader in handsets. They were from Finland, for one thing, which is a country with a population of about 5 million people, and a country that had been kind of like an agrarian economy up until not that long ago. But Nokia basically benefited from being in the Nordic countries, which were got ahead on the whole smartphone thing, on the whole cellular phone thing, and were kind of in the right place at the right time and started making these really reliable phones in the late 80s and early 90s. And at the time, Motorola was really the dominant player, but they kind of were a little slow to switch to digital, and Nokia was smarter about it. And then for about 15 years, they dominated the market. But just as they'd been pretty smart about switching to digital, they were far too slow in figuring out how excited people were going to be about smartphones and touchscreens. And they were loath to give up their high profit margins on these you know, reliable but kind of clunky phones. And they just got left in the dust by Apple and then also Samsung, and ended up selling off their whole phone business to Microsoft, which in Finland was this kind of national trauma, but in the end was probably a smart way to deal with this pretty this rapidly deteriorating situation, as you know, Microsoft's experience with that phone business showed. And Nokia switched into this much less visible business of mobile infrastructure. So it's stuff that most of us don't see, but it's the guts of the wireless world. It's all the antenna and radio transmitters and all the stuff that allows us to download movies and do all the things that we do on our phones. So that's what they do now, and they've done pretty well at it. I mean, they're not as big as they were in their heyday, but they're pretty successful at doing this. And they're really hoping that as we, as our hunger for data, for faster and more data increases, they'll be able to make more and more money supplying that.
And when about was that shift? When was that transaction to Microsoft?
That was they ended up selling it off in 2012, I'm sorry, I think it was right around 2012, 2013 that the sale happened. You know, along with that was like 30,000, they, you know, basically got rid of about 30,000 employees and really downsized. But they'd had this successful networks business that had been growing and growing over the years, and they just decided to put all their eggs in that basket.
Right, right. And so what do we expect to see next from them as they've focused so much on mobile infrastructure and as mobile technology is demanding and does require great change constantly? Are they keeping up with that, and do we see them emerging as a leader in that area?
They are. I mean, they recently bought Alcatel-Lucent, which was a competitor in the space, and that puts them, you know, behind Huawei, which is still the biggest, the Chinese company that really dominates the industry. But you know, Nokia is doing well, and for all of these guys, the really important thing is these transitions to new generations of wireless signals. So 5G is the thing everyone's talking about. The hope is that all of, you know, we're all going to get new phones, and they're going to need to be new antennas, and all the stuff needs to be kind of replaced to supply this newer, faster, richer data generation. So, you know, it remains to be seen whether people actually are interested in getting more data and paying for it. But for all of these guys, including Nokia, that's really where the growth is going to have to come from.
And I think it's interesting that you mentioned Huawei, because they've kind of been quiet enough that we tend to forget about them a lot, because, you know, for a while they were making devices. I know they were working on tablets and stuff for a while. And they had so many stories that would pop up about them and security concerns and things like that, that it seems like they had kind of fallen away and had just been but not gone away. So interesting that they've just been kind of quietly, working in this space. Less visibly.
Yeah, I mean, the whole industry is kind of, it's not really a consumer industry. The customers for a Huawei or a Nokia in the networks business are, you know, the Verizons and the Deutsche Telekoms of the world. So they don't need to really reach consumers in that way. And for Huawei, there is this, you know, additional tension in places like the U.S. around how comfortable we are with Chinese companies, mm-hmm. you know, controlling parts of our data infrastructure. And so I think they do have to walk this tricky line with the phones, but also with the network stuff.
Right, indeed. Well, very, very interesting stuff, and we appreciate you bringing us up to speed on what Nokia has been doing. Thanks so much for being with us today, Drake Bennett from Bloomberg Businessweek.
Thanks.
All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, and we're going to check in and see what's happening today on the Startup Showcase back in just a bit on 720 WGN.